Please welcome Rick Box.
Well, good morning. It's my pleasure to be able to introduce our speaker today. Our speaker is not only a Ivy League PhD, but he's probably more known for his role as being the highest level executive in a Fortune 500 company to become a whistleblower. And he spent almost 3 years wearing a wire for the FBI. Imagine the stress of that each and every day. And he's become a good friend over the last couple of years to me, and I think you're really going to enjoy his amazing story of redemption and hope and second chances. So let's give a warm Kansas City welcome to Mark Whitaker.
Thank you very much. Boy, it's wonderful to be here in Overland Park, and I just want to let you know that thousands and thousands are praying for you. It's even a special request at our church this week was to pray for Overland Park with the tragedy that you've had to endure the last days. So just want to let you know in Cincinnati and cities across the country are praying for you. So appreciate the opportunity to be here. Very honored, very humbled to present the story that my wife and I and our three children shared an interesting journey over the last 20 plus years, and appreciate the opportunity to share it with you today. But when you go back to work today, just imagine that you have a tape recorder attached to your body, that you have another tape recorder in a briefcase, and a third tape recorder in a special notebook, three different tape recorders. And that you'd be taking your coworkers, your supervisors, and in some cases, your friends. Now imagine doing that every day for 3 years. That's exactly what I did. I was a lot younger, man, at that time. I'm 56 years old now. But in my early 30s, I met four FBI agents in the morning. They'd shave my chest, hook microphones to my chest, check the batteries of three different tape recorders, and I'd wear a wire taping my coworkers, my supervisors, and my friends every day, unbeknownst to them. So it's an interesting journey. I'd like to share with you how I became an informant, some of the huge mistakes that I made during the time I was an informant, and what I've learned since then. The company I was wearing a wire against is no average company. They're known as Archer Daniels Midland, commonly known as ADM, one of the largest food additive companies in the world, headquartered in Decatur, Illinois, but they've got 400 plus manufacturing plants around the world. And I want to make it clear right now, and it's very important, ADM had 30,000 employees then when I joined them in 1989, and they have 30,000 plus employees today. And those employees went to work doing the right thing morally and ethically every day. There were four employees at the top that greed became our focus. And I was one of those four. And we lost our way, and we went to federal prison, and we deserved exactly what we got. So I just wanted to make it clear that ADM's a great company, even then and still today. And the employee did the right thing. It just had four bad apples at the top. And I was one of those bad apples. And like I said, we got exactly what we deserved. As I mentioned, they produce a lot of the food additives that would be in your foods. You purchase Kellogg's breakfast cereal and orange juices and Coca-Cola and Pepsi's and Campbell's soup and so on. They're the ingredients that are in the foods that we buy in our grocery store every day. So they touch our lives with their products all around the world. When I joined them in 1989, I was divisional president of their biotech division. I'm a PhD biochemist. I was divisional president of their biotech division and corporate vice president of the company. I was 32 years old at that time. And I can remember the first two employees that I met were two pilots to fly one of the multiple corporate jets that we had. I was ranked number four. We had a chairman, a vice chairman, a president, and then myself. I was the fourth highest ranked executive. And like I said, one of the first employees I met were two pilots to fly the corporate jets that I could fly on anytime I wanted to all around the world. And boy, I had my Justin Bieber, my Britney Spears, and my Charlie Sheen moment all in 1 week. I thought I was a rock star. 32 years old, my base salary was 300, this is 1989, keep in mind, you're talking 24, 25 years ago. My base salary was $350,000 a year 25 years ago. But in a public company, most of your compensation is not base salary. Most of it's stock options in a public company. And with the stock options, it was in the seven figures. And at age 32, growing up in a family that never saw $100,000 a year, and all of a sudden being earning seven figures between the stock options and the base salary, like I said, I thought I was a rock star. I thought I was Bon Jovi, flying around on those corporate jets, and I really lost my way. I became very greed-focused and almost became an obsession and an addiction with greed. I went out and I remember bought a huge house, eight-bedroom house, eight-car garage, and within a couple months, I filled that eight-car garage with eight cars. Like I said, the Justin Bieber moment. Had the Ferrari, two BMWs, two Mercedes, and so on. My whole focus was changing. Not the focus that I had when I grew up in a small town an hour north of Cincinnati. My parents, 87 years old, still live in the same home that I grew up in as a child at 87 years old. And they taught me the right things to do. I had the right moral compass. They forced me to go to church during that time of my life. And I had the right moral compass. And I don't blame any of the things that happened in my life in my 30s on my parents. I got to a level of power in a huge corporation. We were number 56 on the Fortune 500. And I think today they're number 27 on the Fortune 500 at ADM. They're about $90 billion in revenue today. And we were multi-billion in revenue even then. And like I said, when I got to the level of that position at that age, our CEO was 75 years old, our president was 69 years old, and there I was, 32 years old, right there in the ranks with them. So then you say, Mark, why would you blow the whistle in your own company? I just mentioned that the CEO and the president are double my age. So even being number four, I even had further room to grow. Why would you blow the whistle in your own company? Well, the answer to that question is not an easy one. The answer to that question is because of my wife, Ginger. And my wife, I've been with Ginger, and I've met her, and we went to our first junior high dance when she was 13, and I was 14. She was in 7th grade, and I was in 8th grade. And her mom took us to the junior high dance, and my mom picked us up. And I tell you, we're married 35 years this June. And for me to stand here today and tell you that I'm married 35 years to that woman, I want to make it clear is that the divorce rate for people that are incarcerated, if you serve 5 years and longer in prison, the divorce rate, the official statistic, is a 99% divorce rate if you serve 5 years and longer in prison. I served 8 years and 8 months. And my wife and I celebrate our 35-year anniversary, 35th this year. So I don't take that lightly. That my wife and I and our three children were ever to not only survive this ordeal, but we thrived it and became stronger than ever. So Ginger noticed lots of changes with me. I was then 3 years with the company, obsessed with work. The more work I did, the more stock options I received. So the more money that I earned. And I became obsessed with it. I did nothing but work. So 3 years with the company, I was then now 35 years old. And she was 34 years old, a year younger than me. One day she set me down, this was November 5th, 1992. And she said, Mark, what is going on with your life? She said, we have three young children, two that we adopted, a 5 and 7 year old. We had another young one at that time in 92, he would have been 6 years old, our biological son. So we have these three young children, you never spend time with them. I never spend time with her. She said, all you do is work. You're consumed with your title and with the corporate jets and all the money and eight cars. She said, we've got no children that can even drive, and we've got eight cars in the garage and two of them with stickers in the window that had been out of the garage for over a year. She said, this is ridiculous. She said, what's going on? And she said, the thing that bothers me the most, Mark, she said, you come home at night and you have dinner with us, but then you're on the phone till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, every night. And I said, Ginger, I have to be on the phone at night. I'm on the phone with Southeast Asia, Singapore, and Korea, in Japan, and they're 12 hours ahead of us. 8 o'clock at night our time in Decatur, Illinois, is 8 o'clock in the morning in Southeast Asia, so I have to be on the phone at night. She said, you have to be on the phone with them 3 or 4 hours every night? Why would you have to do that? She said, for 7 months, that's all I've seen you consumed on the phone like that. And I said, well, 7 months, I've been assigned a mentor that's teaching me how to do price fixing, and I have to be on the phone because we have a price fixing scheme going on with our competitors. She was a stay-at-home mom raising 3 young kids, and she said, well, what's price fixing? Like I said, I've known her since the 7th grade. So I started explaining to her. I said, well, it's where we get together with our competitors, and we fix the prices of our ingredients, and we make a lot of extra money. I said, everybody's doing it. It's common in business. They tell me that everybody's doing it. She said, so you're involved 7 months? And I said, yeah, I had a mentor assigned to me 7 months ago to show me how to do it. She said, how long has it been going on in the company? And I said, well, over a decade it's been going on in the company. But in our division that I was president of for 7 months. She said, well, who pays for that theft, for that price fixing, for that international cartel? Who pays that? And I said, well, basically the consumers pay that, because when Coca-Cola or Kellogg's or Kraft or Pillsbury, the food companies you would buy some of your foods from, when they pay added price for the ingredients, that gets passed as their profit margins locked in, and that gets passed to the consumer. So I said, someone would buy $50 of groceries, they may be paying just an extra dollar or two for $50 worth of groceries from that price fixing. She said, you mean my grandma is paying for that? Where we have a 13,000 square foot house with an 8-car garage, and my grandma's paying that, my aunt, my uncle, my dad, my brother? I said, yeah, but it's only a dollar or two out of $50 groceries. She said, Mark, I can't live with this. She said, I'm telling you, you're involved 7 months. What a perfect opportunity to turn yourself into the authorities, because you're just being taught how to do it. It's the perfect opportunity to expose this case. I said, Ginger, if I turn myself into authorities, I could go to prison. We'll lose this house, these cars, all these things I was obsessed with. I said, we'll lose everything. Our kids are no longer being in private schools. As quick as I said that, she came back and she said, I'd rather be homeless than live in a house where illegal activity's going on. And she said, I'm telling you, Mark, you either tell the FBI or I will. And she meant it. And within an hour, after confessing to my wife, a case that was going on over a decade, the case that I was involved with myself for 7 months, I was confessing for 4 hours with the FBI. And I'm going to tell you something. I don't know if any of you have ever went to the FBI and tell them you're stealing $1 billion a year. It's an interesting reaction. That phone was ringing off the hook. I mean, there were calls made all the way to Louis Freeh, the director of the FBI in Washington, D.C. I mean, they saw this was, at that time, it became the largest antitrust, the largest price-fixing case in U.S. history at that time. If you go to the FBI museum today, at their headquarters, they have a museum. They have the equipment that I wore during that time in that museum, that the wires and the tape recorders that I wore for those 3 years during that time. And by the way, one of the agents that I, after I confessed, one of the agents that I worked undercover with, his name is Bob Herdon, Robert Herdon, that lives here in Overland Park. I met him at the airport yesterday and had lunch with him and two of his other agents. And I tell you, the first thing he does, and every time I see him, I've done several events with Bob Herdon together, one of them at Quantico FBI Academy 2 years ago. And the first thing he did, he hugged me and said, Mark, I'm proud of you. And after everything I put those agents through, as I share this story, it amazes me that he could feel that way after the journey that I put them on during that time. I don't have the normal resume of a white-collar criminal. I went to The Ohio State University. Maybe people does feel that is a resume of a white-collar criminal. But my wife and I went to The Ohio State University, full scholarship I had. And then I went to Cornell University. I was already working on my PhD at age 21. I started my PhD at Cornell, an Ivy League school in biochemistry, so I was a very gifted student at that time, and graduated with a PhD at a very young age. But even at that age, when I look back now, I could see I was heading the wrong direction. I can remember sitting around with the other PhD students, because biotech was huge back in the 80s. That's when Genentech was starting and so on. I graduated in 1983, and I can remember myself and some of the other PhD students saying, we're gonna make millions of dollars with these degrees, Ivy League, PhD, biochemistry. And I can remember already at 21, me thinking that. And we did make millions of dollars, and then I made $20 a month for 9 years in federal prison. Let me switch gears for a minute and just talk about what life was like to wear wire as a civilian for the FBI. As I mentioned to you, I'd meet them early in the morning, they shaved my chest, hooked microphones to my chest, and then I'd meet with them sometimes 6 o'clock to midnight at night and turn over tapes a couple nights a week for debriefings and so on. It became a life, another job. I would build the company during the day, and because I had to act like a loyal executive, and be tearing that very company down at night. And like I said, I did that for 3 years. And it was a long time to have a life at odds with itself. Build during the day, tear it down at night for 3 years. And these meetings were not just in Decatur, Illinois. Like I said, we had several corporate jets. We could fly anywhere we wanted to, anytime we wanted to. And these meetings were in Hong Kong and Zurich, Switzerland, and Vancouver and Paris. They were all around the world. There were 2 or 3 price-fixing meetings a month all around the world. And following us around at these meetings was a green lamp. And this green lamp looks like it came from a yard sale. Just think of a green lamp at a yard sale that's priced at $3 or $4 and you think that's even too much. Well, this green lamp had the video feed because the FBI and the prosecutors, they wanted to show a jury something, not just let the jury hear something. So the video camera was in this green lamp. I would let the FBI know where the meeting was taking place. They would get the green lamp in the meeting room. I would have all the tape recorders on me, my briefcase, my notebook, and so on. They would be in the next room, and they could control with a remote control controller, move the camera left, right, up, down, and that green lamp from the next room with a monitor, always where these meetings take place. And you know that green lamp was at 2 or 3 meetings a month for 3 years. That green lamp is the Shangri-La in Singapore, and the Mandarin Hotel in Hong Kong, and the Four Seasons Hotel in Chicago, and the Marriott at Orange County Airport in California. And not one person noticed that green lamp, and no matter where they were meeting at, it was in that room, 2 or 3 meetings a month for 3 years. And I tell you what, I thank God that the 11 guys that were stealing $1 billion for their own companies were all men. Because I'm convinced if there was a woman among us, a woman would have said, you know what, that green lamp that looks like it came from a yard sale was at a different country 2 weeks ago and it's following us around the world. But when you've got several guys that are getting $1 billion each for their own companies and making millions of dollars of stock options as a result of it, I learned it firsthand and I saw it firsthand, greed blinds you. They didn't see, that lamp was 3 or 4 feet from where you're sitting for 3 years, 2 or 3 times a month, and they didn't see it until jury trial, and they saw the tapes from it. And everybody was convicted in this case. During a price-fixing meeting in the Orange County Airport in California, the equipment that the FBI had 20 years ago is not near as sophisticated they would have today. This is 1992, keep in mind. So you're talking 22 years ago. The tape recorder in my briefcase started clicking, and I was sitting as close as you are to each other around this table at the Irvine Marriott near the Orange County Airport in California. I had to open that briefcase, click that recorder to get that sound to stop. So here's a lamp. This was 1993 by that time. Here's a lamp sitting 3 feet from him, already falling around for a year. My briefcase is clicking. I'm stopping that. And not one person noticed, and I was sitting as close as you are to each other. I'm telling you, I lived it, I saw it. Greed blinds you, completely blinds you. After wearing a wire 2 years, I was spent. Keep in mind, I wore one for 3, but by 2 years, I didn't know who I was. I was having a nervous breakdown. When the FBI wired me up, they would say, Mark, if these guys catch you, I'm telling you, they will kill you. This is serious stuff, and I heard that every day from the FBI. They say that on the Discovery Channel documentary. It's on my website, markwhitaker.com, where the real FBI agents in 2010 filmed my wife and I a Discovery Channel documentary, and they talk about that. That my life was in danger when this was going on. And to live that for 3 years was starting to take a toll. So one night, and this scene that I'm about ready to describe was so pivotal in the case. They had actors reenact that on this documentary, on this Discovery Channel documentary that's on markwhitaker.com, my website. Came out 2010. I'm out on the driveway with a shirt and tie on, a gas leaf blower, thunderstorm, much more than even today, thunder, lightning, 3 in the morning, blowing leaves off the driveway with a gas leaf blower. And I couldn't imagine why my neighbors weren't doing the same. I thought that was normal behavior. That's how far gone I was. My wife heard that gas leaf blower. She comes out on the driveway, umbrella over her head. She said, "It's 3 in the morning." Ginger said, "Come back to the house. Come back to the family." She said, "More importantly, you need God in your life." And I said, "Ginger, why would I need God? It was just announced that when our 69-year-old president retires, it was circulated to all our shareholders, I'm in line to become the next president of ADM. Not divisional president that I currently am, president of the whole company. I'm going from number 4 to number 2. There was a Dane Bosworth article that was circulated from our CEO to all the shareholders describing that about 2 months before that scene. She said, "Mark, you've got to be delusional. You're out of your mind. The only reason why they announced you were likely to be the next president, they don't know you're the informant." She said, "You're bringing down the CEO won't be able to stay there. The vice chairman is likely to go to prison. The president is likely to go to prison. You're bringing down the top executives of ADM and that board of directors have supported them for 30 years. Don't ever think that you're still going to be the president of that company when they learn that you're wearing a wire for 3 years. She said, "I thought you always knew you would be working somewhere else when this is all over with." She walked back in that driveway, or she walked back in the house from that driveway, and I started thinking, she is right. I am going to be fired for being a whistleblower when they learn that I'm the informant. And back in the 90s, it would be easier to get a job as a felon than a corporate whistleblower in corporate America. Corporate whistleblowers, it's tough even now, but it would even be tougher back in the 90s. So I made the decision, being as smart as I am, I made the decision, well, will the company be giving me, when most people at that level, as you read in the newspapers, that's what I read always when I was in my 30s, I read all these guys that got let go from their company, top executive, they get golden parachutes. They get huge severance packages. They get to take their stock options with them. And I thought, wow, when these guys learn why I'm wearing a wire 3 years, I'm not going to get a golden parachute. They're not going to write me any kind of severance package. I'm going to be the enemy. I'm going to be the witness against them in one of the largest trials, corporate trials in history. There's going to be no golden parachute. So I decided to write my own. A few years earlier, my 3 friends of mine, president of ADM Mexico and 2 other vice presidents, we lost $660,000 in a bad Nigerian investment, and we reimbursed ourselves from ADM funds. We did. And we did that, we think, well, gosh, the company can't come after us. They're stealing $1 billion a year on a price-fixing scheme. This $660,000 is minimal. So now I'm out on this drive, and I'm thinking, well, how can I get my own golden parachute? I made the decision. I'm going to write $9 million to myself. That'll give me 3 or 4 years of the compensation that I was used to making with the base salary and stock options and bonuses. I'd write $9 million, and that way I've got 3 or 4 years to get back on my feet. And I thought with the accountants, one, they were scared to death of me with the level I was in the company. But if they did tell the people I worked for, and if they came to me, I thought, said, "Mark, you stole $9 million from us," my answer was going to be, well, how can you guys turn me in when you're stealing $1 billion a year on the price fixing case? Their fraud was larger, so I was protected. So I went in that next day, and over a few months, over 5 checks, I wrote a $3.5 million check. I wrote a $2.5 million check, and over a few months, $9 million. This is how smart I was. The day that ADM learned that I was the mole, the day they learned that I was the informant, when the case went public, they contact the FBI and they contact the media and say, "Mark Whitaker's no white knight informant. He stole $9 million from us." They made the decision. I put them in flames on price fixing. They were going to put me in flames for fraud. They went to prison for price fixing, and I went to prison for that fraud. And the amazing thing is, and I give Bob Herdon a lot of credit for this, out of here in Overland Park, that they still supported me, those 4 agents that I worked for, and they went to the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney in Chicago, working behind the scenes, trying to get me the best plea deal they could get me. They still were fighting for me, even when they knew I took $9 million when I worked for them. They told the prosecutor, they said, "Mark Whitaker's the highest level executive in U.S. history that become a whistleblower. If we go after him, we'll never get a whistleblower to come forward again. They said Mark Whitaker stole $9 million at a time his mental stability was at its worst, when he's blowing driveways off at 3 in the morning, because my wife was sharing all these things with them as I was cracking under the pressure. They told the U.S. attorney that they get trained to go undercover. And they see a psychiatrist every 3 months to help deal with a double life when they go undercover. But they said Mark did it for 3 years without any mental health counseling, without any support. And the U.S. attorney in Chicago agreed to a 3-year plea deal. He said, you're right, Mark helped us more than he hurt us. And he agreed to a 3-year plea deal. But more importantly, he agreed to a mitigating sentencing hearing. Mitigating sentencing hearing, where those FBI agents, the four of them, could march in front of a judge and say the same thing that I just described to you that they said to the prosecutor about all the assistance that I gave them for 3 years and how I was having a meltdown. My lawyer said, Mark, I think with this mitigating sentencing hearing, we're going to get you a 6 months. We can get you 6 months in prison. My wife by my side, when he told me about this plea deal, this deal of a lifetime, this plea agreement, 6 months in federal prison. He said, I think in the end of the day, that's what I can get you. I fired that lawyer, threw that plea deal in a trash can. My wife begged me to sign it. And I fought that case with everything I had. Sold my house and cars even to pay attorneys. Fought that case with everything I had for 2 years to get a 10.5-year sentence instead. And I had a 6-month plea agreement right in front of me. My wife's done a lot of interviews. You look at my website, markwhitaker.com, and you see her talking. And here's what she commonly says. People ask me, Ginger, with a 99% divorce rate for people that go through this, that are served 5 years and longer, how did you do it? How'd you stay with your husband? Why did you do it? And Ginger's common answer is this. Her faith would not allow a divorce. Her vows meant something to her, to live through thick and thin, and to stay together through thick and thin. Her vows meant something, till death do you part. So she said divorce was not an option because of her faith. But she said murder was an option, and she considered it twice. And I can tell you, when I took a 6-month plea deal and threw it in a trash can, I can tell you firsthand on the car ride on the way home on that, murder was an option. Well, what I just described to you just then is what was in the movie The Informant. Matt Damon, as you know, played me. He's my identical twin, so you can see why they chose him. I said, Matt Damon, wait till you're 56. I told him, see how he looks. But anyway, that's what The Informant was about. But what I want to emphasize now from here on is what's happened since then. I went to prison in 98, just like The Informant chose. People would think, I would have thought at that time, life is ending. Especially the way I knew life, it was ending. But I'd like to tell you what's happened the last 16, 17 years since that point. The rest of the story. When I had a 10.5-year prison sentence, there's no parole in the federal system. That was taken out in the 80s. I was going to prison in 98. So there's no parole. You get 15% off good behavior. So I had to do 8 years and 8 months on a 10.5-year sentence, and there's nothing shorter that you can get in a federal sentence. So when I knew I had 9 years basically of prison to do, I tried to take my own life. I pulled my car in one of those garages, gave up all hope, and I could not imagine. I saw the divorce rate was 99%, so I said, I'm not going to have a family when I get out. Statistics was against me. I said, I'm not going to get a job when I get out, convicted felon. Even with a Cornell PhD, I'd be coming out of prison at age 49, going in at age 41, coming out a convicted felon. So I wrote my wife a 17-page letter. I wrote all my kids letters. And I tried to take my own life. I gave up all hope. I thought they'd be better without me. I was hospitalized for a month. We had a groundskeeper that showed up at 8:30 every morning. He showed up at 6:30. Out of 7 years, he showed up at 8:30 every morning. He showed up at 6:30 that morning. I was unconscious. I was 20 minutes away, they said, from being dead. Something tugged at his heart. I was mad at him because he spoiled my plan that day. I was hospitalized for a month. I was treated for bipolar disorder and post-traumatic stress syndrome. heavily medicated. Then I was sent back home, and I saw dark days ahead because I still knew I had 9 years of prison to do. A man showed up at my house. His name was Ian House, a stranger. I'd never met him before. Showed up at my house, said, "Mark, I just read about you in the newspapers, about how all the things that I just described to you for these last 20, 25 minutes. I read all that, read where you tried to take your own life a month ago." This was fall of 1997. He said, "Mark, let me tell you something." He was CFO of a pharmaceutical company and a man with 5 children. He was part of a group called CBMC, Christian Businessmen Connection. Never heard of it. I didn't. He said, "Mark, prison's going to be the beginning of your life, and you're going to find your true purpose in life with the journey you're about ready to start." I just tried to kill myself a month earlier. I went and told my wife in the kitchen, I said, "Honey, there's someone out on the front porch that's crazier than I am." She said, "Well, maybe you ought to listen to him." I went back out on that porch, talked to him, and he said, "Mark, I'd like to take you through a study called Operation Timothy, Introduction to the Bible." He said, "You got 7 months before you go to prison. I'd like to spend 5, 6, 7 hours a week with you." This is a man with 5 children, CFO of a pharmaceutical company. I know he didn't have the time. He spent 5, 6, 7 hours a week for 7 months before I went to prison and planted a seed that changed my life forever. Forever. Through this Operation Timothy, this introduction to the Bible. 2 weeks after I went to prison, another man showed up. I wasn't a believer yet, wasn't a Christian yet, but a seed was planted. This man showed up, told me his name was Chuck Colson. He said he read about me in the paper, and he went to Brown, I went to Cornell, we both went to prison about the same age. I was addicted to greed, he was addicted to power. We both were at the top of our game, him a White House counsel under President Nixon in the White House, me in corporate America at the 56th largest company in America. We both were top of our game, and we were both heading to federal prison. He went to prison in the 70s. So he saw a lot of himself in my case. And he mentored me for 9 years. And he nurtured that seed that Ian House planted. Chuck Colson died 2 years ago this past Monday, the 21st of April, 2 years ago at age 80. And he impacted my life, he and Ian House. God put 2 ambassadors for Christ in front of me right at the right time. And it changed my life forever. My 3rd month of prison, I got down on my knees, June of 98, 16 years ago. And for the first time in my life, even though I'd went to church most of my life, for the first time in my life, I got down on my knees and surrendered my life to Jesus Christ. And said, "God, I made a train wreck of my life. And I need some guidance here. I need to turn the steering wheel over to somewhere else, someone else. Because for me to think I was the smartest man in the room, I wasn't doing too well." And I tell you what, I had peace and contentment like I never had before. I went from making 7 figures a year with a bonus and so on for 7 years to $20 a month for 9 years. And I took 61 people through Operation Timothy, the same introduction to the Bible study that Ian House did with me. Helped hundreds of guys learn how to read and how to write in prison and get their GEDs. And just like Ian House said, he said, "Mark, you're going to find your true purpose in life." I found my purpose. And it wasn't use that education to become the president of ADM like my obsession was during that time. It was to use my education to help other people, to serve other people. My wife and I went to a graduation May of last year where a guy graduated number 1 in his class in marketing in Florida. We stood by his side like his dad and mom. He was an 8th grade dropout when I met him in prison. I took him through Operation Timothy. I helped him get his GED in prison. I assisted him as he got a 2-year degree in prison and watched him in society with his wife and a child by his side graduate number 1 in his class with a 4-year degree. And I can tell you, there was no corporate jet. There was no set of stock options. There was no bonus that was ever more rewarding than that moment. And I knew then what my purpose was. And it was not selfish leadership like I was living. It was servant leadership to help other people improve their lives. In prison, we got better as a family, not bitter. The difference between those two words, better and bitter, is the letter I. I for selfishness, and the word better, E for eternal value. And we got better. I will tell you something about my wife. There's a book called Against All Odds that was published in 2010, mostly against my wife, Mark Whitaker, Against All Odds, how she held things together during very turbulent times. They added her days up where she spent from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. sitting in federal prisons with my children. They added her days up, and it added up to 3 years and 8 months. They allow 20 hours a weekend in federal prison for your family to visit. My wife visited 20 hours a weekend with my children for 9 years. She moved to 3 different states to live next to each prison and walked over to that visiting for 9 years, the 20 hours that she was allowed in there. My family went to prison with me. I've been out for 8 years, and there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about the hell that I put them through. I can remember that first Christmas in Yazoo, Mississippi. My kids were crying. You don't count days when you're in prison. We use Christmases as the milestone. I can remember the kids crying and sad, all three of them. I was depressed. And Ginger said, look, this was 1998. I wasn't getting out until 2006. Ginger said, hey, where are we all sad for? Look at the people that in the military aren't even seeing their families at Christmas. What's it matter if we're in our living room or a prison visiting room? We're together. And that's the attitude my wife had for 9 years. She was a super glue that held things together during some very turbulent times. God redeemed me that day in June of 98. He pardoned me, he forgave me, and he gave me a clean slate. And then he touched the hearts of society. My family, who stayed with me during very turbulent times. The food companies we stole from, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Tyson Foods, Procter & Gamble, Quaker Oats. 11 of them got together. They had a lawyer named Ken Adams out of Dickstein and Shapiro that called my wife in August of 98. We were out of money. My wife was literally about ready to move back home with her parents, with our 3 children. She got a call in August of 98, and this lawyer said, Ginger Whitaker, if it wasn't for you, price fixing will still be going on like it had been going on for over a decade. And your husband wearing a wire to expose this case, it still would have been going on if he hadn't done that. For that, we want to take care of your family for a decade. There's a whole chapter of that in the new big book called Against All Odds. They took care of my family. The people I stole from took care of my family for 9 years. If that's not an example of God touching hearts, I don't know what is. That's a miracle of God. The FBI agents and prosecutors had every reason to hate me. $9 million I stole from when I worked for them. Took a 6-month plea deal and threw it in a trash can. They become my biggest supporters. There's a half dozen interviews from the FBI in 2010, 2011 on my website. Bob Hurton picked me up at the airport, taking me to lunch yesterday, hugging me. They became my biggest supporters. If that's not God touching hearts, I don't know what is. My career, another reason why I tried to take my own life in 97, I thought I'd never be hired again. I had 4 offers when I got out, the day I got out in 2006, 8 years ago. 4 offers. I joined a biotech company. They were all 4 biotech companies and pharmaceutical companies. I joined one of them. You don't start off the head of finance when you steal $9 million. Being a PhD biochemist, I started in research, no access to money. 3 years ago, I was promoted to COO and chief science officer, the number 2 executive in that company. I've been there 8 years. And if that's not an example of God touching hearts, I don't know what is. Miracles happen. My life was a train wreck before having God in my life, and he put me on a track where I could rely on him and finally get some results that would put my life in a positive direction compared to the direction it was going. I'd like to leave you with this. Having God in my life 16 years ago and surrendered my life to Jesus Christ was the most important decision I've ever made in my life. And boy, he blessed me with a good wife that stuck with me through thick and thin. 3 years undercover, 9 years of prison, visiting 9 years, 20 hours a weekend in prisons. I put my family through hell. Only God could touch their hearts for them to forgive me and love me, my wife and children, like they do. I hear my three children say often, the only marriage they could imagine ever happen is the marriage like their mom and dad. And for me to hear that after everything I put them through, it touches my heart. And I urge you, if you don't have God in your life, or if you're like me going to church and think, oh yeah, I'm a Christian, I went to church last Sunday like you inherited, I was that person. If you don't have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, I urge you to consider it, and I urge you to explore it. It was by far the most important decision I ever made. And I was in prison the 7 years that I was one of the top executives of one of the biggest companies in the world. And I was a free man when I went to 9 years in prison. It took me going to prison at $20 a month to become a free man. And I'd like to end this with the prayer that I said in June of 98 when I turned my life over for the first time at age 41 to Jesus Christ. And I'd like to invite you to join me in that prayer in silence if you'd like to bring Jesus into your life. I'd like to invite you. And if you already have Jesus in your life, you already have a relationship with God, feel free to join me to renew or re-energize or recommit your life to Jesus Christ. Let's pray. Father, I am a sinner. And I know there's no good works that will get you to forgive me and get to heaven. I know the only way now, Father, I know the only way to have your forgiveness and have eternal life for my soul is that I know you sent your Son, Jesus Christ, to die a horrific death on the cross to be resurrected, and was resurrected 3 days later after that death and ascended to heaven. And I know my only way to you, Father, is through your Son, who you sacrificed for my sins. And I know it's not because of good works, Father. I know it's because of grace and mercy. I know I don't deserve any forgiveness or redemption, but because of your tremendous grace and mercy, I know that I have it. And Father, I'm asking you to continue to guide me each and every day of my life to keep me on the right path, to prevent the train wreck that happened before I knew you. And I pray that in Jesus' name. Amen. One other little administrative thing. There's a card on your table. If you wouldn't mind, there's a lot of work that goes into these, as you know. They announce the committee who puts these together, and there's a lot of effort that go into it. And we'd love to have your contact information, but that bottom right-hand box, look on the bottom, there's a bottom right-hand box. If you wouldn't mind putting a check mark in that box, a check mark, if you brought Jesus Christ and prayed for the first time and you brought one Jesus to be part of your life, to put a check box. And if you wouldn't mind putting an R in that box, if you renewed or re-energized or recommitted your life to Jesus Christ. Check box, if you prayed for the first time, and an R if you recommitted your life to Jesus Christ, and then your contact information on that attendance card. And listen, I'm blessed to be here today. Appreciate the opportunity to share with you. Praying for all of you here in Overland Park with the tragedy you guys went through the past week. And God bless all of you. Thank you very much.